Escuelas oficiales de idiomas de Andalucía. Comprensión oral. Inglés. Nivel avanzado C2. Tarea 1. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
Extract 0.
There is that Robert Frost poem, The Road Not Taken. So do you ever think, if you had taken that road, if you'd gone to art college, what you would be doing now if you hadn't started acting?
Yeah, I think it's more about my personality slightly. The reason I started speech and drama was more for the speech element. I had a real lisp when I was a kid. I had this really strong lisp, and I had to go to these kind of elocution lessons. And I used to have to say seashells on the seashore. And eventually that disappeared, like it does for a lot of children. But then the drama element I really got into. And suddenly when I was getting up to do these improvisations or these poems, I was very happy. And it just brought something out of me. And
Extract 1.
I thought, never start your books at the beginning. Always start with something going on. And I try to do that, like an unnatural death. Scarpetta's on her way out of the building. You know, all hell is broken loose and she's flying out the door. And I was like, whoa, what's
Where's
happening?
She going? And is that the way that you write? Are you setting a scene and asking yourself what's happening? Or do you know in advance?
Oh, I do that all the time. I have her find things and I don't know why she found them. Then I've got to figure out what it means.
So you don't lay out the plot in advance before you start writing?
No, I don't. I start thinking about it, but I get surprised. Now I'm supposed to figure out what it means. I think that's not fair. You know, when I don't.
So you're retrofitting the crime to the evidence.
Then I figured out what she was looking for.
Extract 2.
In fact, what was your education like?
My education was probably spoilt by my behaviour. I wasn't a particularly compliant kid because at home, my dad ruled the roost. You know, what my dad said went. So the minute I left the house, no one was going to tell me what to do. So I had a bad attitude towards authority and I wore it proudly. And I was always getting in trouble at school because I guess, you know, a lot of teachers in the 70s didn't really like kids. You know, when your parents sent you to school to learn, they didn't really get involved in your education. They didn't have time. Cooking for 6 kids, washing clothes. There wasn't time to...
And you say your dad ruled the roost at home. He was a tough dad.
He wasn't like...
He was a builder, wasn't he?
He was a builder. I mean, he wasn't one thing, but he was definitely prone to, you know, explosions.
Extract 3.
When it happens, I don't think that you can do it so consciously, because it would feel much more constructed as well. But I think there's an intuitive, I guess, which it's a word that I'm using a lot, but it's kind of true. It seems like you're trying to get away from answering too specifically. I just try to allow myself to understand it not intellectually and see how it feels. And when I feel that there are more possibilities of how you perceive the image or the sound or the dialogue or the story, that's where I feel more comfortable. Like there's the opportunity and the space for people to enter this world and experience it in their own terms.
Extract 4.
I think part of the reason why we were successful in America was because we were so British.
Mm. Did you get any advice as to how to deal with the limelight and that sudden superstar level of fame?
Well, everybody thinks they're an expert on fame. You know, everybody thinks they know what you should do and what you shouldn't do. But basically, you know, at the beginning, you're just thrown in front of the headlights. You know, there's no real preparation. And when you're 20, you're not going to listen to someone giving you advice about how to be famous. You know, you're just like, oh, shut up, you know. You just want to get on with it. And I mean, at that point, I hadn't even discovered therapy. So it was really not until quite later that I was like, oh, there's another way of looking at life. You know, growing up, I mean, the beginning of fame, it was a crash course. No one helped me at all.
Extract 5.
Well, I avoid sitting through the premieres too nowadays. Like the first few films I did sit through the premieres, now I can't do it anymore.
Oh, really? But you never go back and sort of check on what you did in The Lobster or Killing
Maybe
of a Sacred...
Like many years later. Like I could, the first couple of films I think I've kind of watched parts of, and it's funny, like it's different to what you remember. Sometimes it's even better to what you remember. Sometimes you're too harsh, you know, on yourself when it's fresh. But when you look back like 10 years later, you might appreciate certain things that you failed to appreciate when you just made them.
Extract 6.
Well, when I was young, when I started, I thought, like everybody else, that the aim was to become mainly, everyone's main vanity was to be marvelous and to be famous. Totally fallen away by now. I have had no contact at all with what's called the art world. I live a quite amazingly restrictive life, and I just go on in this very quiet way. If I hadn't been forced by this interview to make these presumptuous and pretentious statements, I would have been innocently sloshing away in the room next door and carrying on with my work, and that's all it is. I mean, there is a sense of hoping still to be in some sense valid, but if I think I've finished something, but that is the pleasure or the success and nothing to do with the outside world at all.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
Extract 0.
There is that Robert Frost poem, The Road Not Taken. Mm. So do you ever think, if you had taken that road, if you'd gone to art college, what you would be doing now if you hadn't started acting?
Yeah, I think it's more about my personality slightly. The reason I started speech and drama was more for the speech element. I had a real lisp when I was a kid. I had a really strong lisp, and I had to go to these kind of elocution lessons. And I used to have to say sheet cells, seashells on the seashore. And eventually that disappeared, like it does for a lot of children. But then the drama element I really got into. And suddenly when I was getting up to do these improvisations or these poems, I was very happy. And it just brought something out of me. And
Extract 1.
I thought, never start your books at the beginning. Always start with something going on. And I try to do that. Like in Unnatural Death, Scarpetta's on her way out of the building. You know, all hell is broken loose and she's flying out the door. And I was like, whoa, 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 what's
Where's
happening?
She going? And is that the way that you write? Are you setting a scene and asking yourself what's happening? Or do you know in advance?
Oh, I do that all the time. I have her find things and I don't know why she found them. Then I've got to figure out what it means.
So you don't lay out the plot in advance before you start writing?
No, I don't. I start thinking about it, but I get surprised. Now I'm supposed to figure out what it means. I think that's not fair. You know, when I don't.
So you're retrofitting the crime to the evidence.
Then I figured out what she was looking for.
Extract 2.
In fact, what was your education like?
My education was probably spoilt by my behaviour. I wasn't a particularly compliant kid because at home, my dad ruled the roost. You know, what my dad said went. So the minute I left the house, no one was going to tell me what to do. So I had a bad attitude towards authority and I wore it proudly. And I was always getting in trouble at school because I guess, you know, a lot of teachers in the 70s didn't really like kids. You know, when your parents sent you to school to learn, they didn't really get involved in your education. They didn't have time. Cooking for six kids, washing clothes. There wasn't time to...
And you say your dad ruled the roost at home. He was a tough dad.
He wasn't like...
He was a builder, wasn't he?
He was a builder. I mean, he wasn't one thing, but he was definitely prone to, you know, explosions.
Extract 3.
When it happens, I don't think that you can do it so consciously, because it would feel much more constructed as well. But I think there's an intuitive, I guess, which it's a word that I'm using a lot, but it's kind of true. It seems like you're trying to get away from answering too specifically. I just try to allow myself to understand it not intellectually and see how it feels. And when I feel that there are more possibilities of how you perceive the image or the sound or the dialogue or the story, that's where I feel more comfortable. Like there's the opportunity and the space for people to enter this world and experience it in their own terms.
Extract 4.
I think part of the reason why we were successful in America was because we were so British.
Did you get any advice as to how to deal with the limelight and that sudden superstar level of fame?
Well, everybody thinks they're an expert on fame. You know, everybody thinks they know what you should do and what you shouldn't do. But basically, you know, at the beginning, you're just thrown in front of the headlights. You know, there's no real preparation. And when you're 20, you're not going to listen to someone giving you advice about how to be famous. You know, you're just like, oh, shut up, you know. You just want to get on with it. And, I mean, at that point, I'd even discovered therapy. So it was really not until quite later that I was like, oh, there's another way of looking at life. You know, growing up, in the beginning of fame, it was a crash course. No one helped me at all.
Extract 5.
Well, I avoid sitting through the premieres too nowadays. Like the first few films I did sit through the premieres, now I can't do it anymore.
Oh, really? But you never go back and sort of check on what you did in The Lobster or Killing
Maybe
of a Sacred...
Like many years later. Like the first couple of films I think I've kind of watched parts of, and it's funny, like it's different to what you remember. Sometimes it's even better to what you remember. Sometimes you're too harsh, you know, on yourself when it's fresh. But when you look back like 10 years later, you might appreciate certain things that you failed to appreciate when you just made them.
Extract 6.
Well, when I was young, when I started, I thought like everybody else that the aim was to become mainly, everyone's main vanity was to be marvelous and to be famous. totally fallen away by now. I have had no contact at all with what's called the art world. I live a quite amazingly restrictive life, and I just go on in this very quiet way. If I hadn't been forced by this interview to make these presumptuous and pretentious statements, I would have been innocently sloshing away in the room next door and carrying on with my work, and that's all it is. I mean, there is a sense of hoping still to be in some sense valid, but if I think I've finished something, but that is the pleasure or the success, and nothing to do with the outside world at all.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 1. Tarea 2. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
So we heard about this decision made at Cabinet yesterday that Ireland will join the EU's Asylum and Migration Pact. Now, the full details aren't yet agreed, but we do know that the pact aims to deliver more efficient returns for unsuccessful applicants, accelerated processing for those from safe countries and those with false documents, and there'll be a new solidarity mechanism to support countries which take a disproportionate share of asylum applicants. So what does all that mean? How will it work in practice? Well, I'm joined now by immigration lawyer Cathal Malone. You're very welcome, Cathal. Thanks
Morning,
for coming in. What do we know about this new pact?
Well, what's interesting, Claire, is maybe a little bit less than we might expect. This is something that's been negotiated within the European Union for the last number of years. There was political agreement reached across all the heads of government in Europe in December to proceed. Now, interestingly, Ireland and Denmark actually have to opt into this measure, and Cabinet has decided to do that this week. But there are still technical negotiations going on around the exact text. However, what we do know is that, for example, there's going to be a mandatory 3-month processing time for international protection or asylum applicants in certain categories, crucially not just, as you said, safe countries, but people who have got no papers or false papers on arrival, which on the most recent figures is 85% of people arriving in Dublin Airport, would be in that process. Now, it's interesting to know how that's going to work, because currently, as we all know, the processing times for applicants in general are over a year. And we now have 13,500 people. And it seems like in excess of 90% of those will now be subject to a mandatory 3-month processing time and a further 3 months thereafter to be deported.
So you're asking, how is this going to work in practice?
Before the pandemic, we had an average of about 3,500 people per year claiming asylum in this country. Since the end of COVID, it's been 13,500, a 10,000 person per annum jump. Now, given that level of a jump, the state at the moment cannot, as we see, accommodate them. But also there's very real issues with, for example, delays in scheduling interviews due to lack of civil servants. There's a lack of office space in Mount Street. And crucially, there's a lack of immigration lawyers in this country to represent people. Now, there's currently a shortage to represent these people if the process takes 12 months. And I'm really unsure how these people will have any effective access to legal advice if they cut that by AGs.
Okay, well, now, we have heard an analysis from a range of politicians, economists, other commentators, which is that the asylum system is being used as a backdoor by those who might be more accurately described as economic migrants. And as a result of that, you have genuine asylum seekers who are stuck in this system that you have described to us. What do you make of that charge?
Well, the first thing I'd say is that if you look at the numbers, at first instance last year, 40% of applications were granted. On appeal, between a quarter and a third of the negative decisions were then overturned. So we're not looking at a situation here where 5% or 10% of people are genuine. Even on the Minister for Justice's own figures, it's roughly 50-50. But actually, if we look at talking about people languishing in the system for longer when they're genuine, that's exactly what they're proposing to do with the new Asylum and Migration Pact. Because it was always understood that you would speed up the processing, historically, of people whose applications were more likely to be genuine. Let's say you're Afghan or you're Syrian, so that these people were not languishing in direct provision for longer than they needed to, they could get on with their lives and get status. Mm-hmm. But under the new Asylum Migration Pact, the only people who are going to get done in 3 months are those who are unlikely to qualify, which logically means that the people who are likely to qualify, your Afghans and your Syrians, are going to spend much longer in the process waiting behind the people who are not meritorious. And that seems to me to be turning things on its head.
Yeah, we also have this solidarity clause, which yes. I mentioned at the beginning. So you would imagine that countries in Europe's southern and eastern borders, so Greece, Italy, others too, that they're getting a disproportionate number of migrants, and that we will either have to accept more of those people or pay in under this solidarity clause to help the countries that are accepting them. Is that how you see that working?
Well, that's how it's supposed to work. So on current figures, if we're taking our fair share based on population, GDP and the number of migrants already here, it's about 650 more per annum than we're currently taking. So not a huge number. Although it does go to show that even with the current supposed crisis, we are below what we should be taking to average it out things across Europe. And if we don't take those 650, then it's a €20,000 per head amount that we pay, which is supposed to go to be used by countries like Italy and Greece to support these people in those countries. And they're much poorer than we are.
What do you think when you hear people saying unvetted people are coming into this country?
Well, the first thing to say is that people are vetted insofar as we can. So when you claim international protection, you're fingerprinted. That's run through Interpol, Europol, and a database called Eurodac, which is across all EU countries, which checks if you've applied for a visa or asylum in any of those countries. And obviously also as part of your international protection claim, there's a very detailed form to be filled out. There's a personal interview lasting hours, and everything that you say will be checked insofar as it can against documentary records. But the reality is, and I think rather thankfully, every person on earth is not in some sort of centralised database with their fingerprints and all the details about them.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
So we heard about this decision made at Cabinet yesterday that Ireland will join the EU's Asylum and Migration Pact. Now, the full details aren't yet agreed, but we do know that the pact aims to deliver more efficient returns for unsuccessful applicants, accelerated processing for those from safe countries and those with false documents, and there'll be a new solidarity mechanism to support countries which take a disproportionate share of asylum applicants. So what does all that mean? How will it work in practice? Well, I'm joined now by immigration lawyer Cathal Malone. You're very welcome, Cathal. Thanks for coming in. What do we know about this new pact?
Well, what's interesting, Claire, is maybe a little bit less than we might expect. This is something that's been negotiated within the European Union for the last number of years. There was political agreement reached across all the heads of government in Europe in December to proceed. Now, interestingly, Ireland and Denmark actually have to opt into this measure, and Cabinet has decided to do that this week. But there are still technical negotiations going on around the exact text. However, what we do know is that, for example, there's going to be a mandatory 3-month processing time for international protection or asylum applicants in certain categories, crucially not just, as you said, safe countries, but people who have got no papers or false papers on arrival, which on the most recent figures is 85% of people arriving in Dublin Airport would be in that process. Now, it's interesting to know how that's going to work, because currently, as we all know, the processing times for applicants in general are over a year. And we now have 13,500 people. And it seems like in excess of 90% of those will now be subject to a mandatory 3-month processing time and a further 3 months thereafter to be deported.
So you're asking, how is this going to work in practice?
Before the pandemic, we had an average of about 3,500 people per year claiming asylum in this country. Since the end of COVID, it's been 13,500, a 10,000 person per annum jump. Now, given that level of a jump, the state at the moment cannot, as we see, accommodate them. But also there's very real issues with, for example, delays in scheduling interviews due to lack of civil servants. There's a lack of office space in Mount Street. And crucially, there's a lack of immigration lawyers in this country to represent people. Now, there's currently a shortage to represent these people if the process takes 12 months. And I'm really unsure how these people will have any effective access to legal advice if they cut that by a year.
We have heard an analysis from a range of politicians, economists, other commentators, which is that the asylum system is being used as a backdoor by those who might be more accurately described as economic migrants. And as a result of that, you have genuine asylum seekers who are stuck in this system that you have described to us. What do you make of that charge?
Well, the first thing I'd say is that if you look at the numbers, at first instance last year, 40% of applications were granted. On appeal, between a quarter and a third of the negative decisions were then overturned. So we're not looking at a situation here where 5% or 10% of people are genuine. Even on the Minister for Justice's own figures, it's roughly 50-50. But actually, if we look at talking about people languishing in the system for longer when they're genuine, that's exactly what they're proposing to do with the new Asylum and Migration Pact. Because it was always understood that you would speed up the processing, historically, of people whose applications were more likely to be genuine. Let's say you're Afghan or you're Syrian, so that these people were not languishing in direct provision for longer than they needed to, they could get on with their lives and get status. Mm-hmm. But under the new Asylum Migration Pact, the only people who are going to get done in 3 months are those who are unlikely to qualify, which logically means that the people who are likely to qualify, your Afghans and your Syrians, are going to spend much longer in the process waiting behind the people who are not meritorious. And that seems to me to be turning things on its head.
Yeah, we also have this solidarity clause, which yes, I mentioned at the beginning. So you would imagine that countries in Europe's southern and eastern borders, so Greece, Italy, others too, that they're getting a disproportionate number of migrants, and that we will either have to accept more of those people or pay in under this solidarity clause to help the countries that are accepting them. Is that how you see that working?
Well, that's how it's supposed to work. So on current figures, if we're taking our fair share based on population, GDP and the number of migrants already here, it's about 650 more per annum than we're currently taking. So not a huge number. Although it does go to show that even with the current supposed crisis, we are below what we should be taking to average it out things across Europe. And if we don't take those 650, then it's a €20,000 per head amount that we pay, which is supposed to go to be used by countries like Italy and Greece to support these people in those countries. And they're much poorer than we are.
What do you think when you hear people saying unvetted people are coming into this country?
Well, the first thing to say is that people are vetted insofar as we can. So when you claim international protection, you're fingerprinted. That's run through Interpol, Europol, and a database called Eurodac, which is across all EU countries, which checks if you've applied for a visa or asylum in any of those countries. And obviously also as part of your international protection claim, there's a very detailed form to be filled out. There's a personal interview lasting hours, and everything that you say will be checked insofar as it can against documentary records. But the reality is, and I think rather thankfully, every person on Earth is not in some sort of centralised database with their fingerprints and all the details about them.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 2. Tarea 3. Dispone de 2 minutos para leer las instrucciones y el contenido de la tarea.
So you're getting tired there. So it's basically slouching, essentially. So if you pull that shoulder blade back and engage the muscles between the two shoulder blades, that's your base of support for anything that's heavy that you're having to maintain using your arm. So if you keep those shoulder muscles in position and you don't let the shoulder drop forward, you've got a much more stable base of support from the shoulder blade right down through the arm. Because anything that you have to do or push or lift with your arm, the actual strength comes from the shoulder blade muscles.
Would you prefer that people weren't carrying things around all day?
I would prefer that if they carry them around, that they have them in a backpack.
Yeah.
On both shoulders.
And also that they've made themselves strong enough to be able to withstand that load.
That's it, absolutely. So we're back to that kind of World Health Organization recommendation of 2 strengthening sessions per week for people under the age of 65 and 3 over the age of 65. So having that strength in your muscles to be able to tolerate something that you have to do outside of your normal comfort zone of movement, that helps safeguard against these niggles.
Is carrying the backpack or the handbag, though, not resistance training in itself?
It depends. It depends on that accumulation and how you're doing it. So if you're strong enough to begin with and you're managing that load so that you're not carrying it for maybe 2 hours at a time, it's all about if you can tolerate it for short periods of time and you build up your tolerance, then you get strong for it. But if you're not strong enough and then you suddenly have to do it out of the blue for 2 or 3 hours, that's where the problem comes, because your body is not able to tolerate that and it has to adjust and make those adaptations. And they then accumulate stress in your system that if you don't watch out for, it builds over time and you get this development of a kind of a niggly, seems to come out of the blue type injury.
And I think people would be surprised if they thought that that niggle that they have in some part of their back is coming from what they're carrying around.
That's it, absolutely. So when we see people come into the clinic and they come in with a huge big bag and they're complaining about pain in the neck and the shoulder, that's the first thing we talk about. What's in that bag? How often are you carrying it around? And in fact, a lot of people, they get into their car, into the driver's seat with a big heavy bag, then they put the heavy bag onto the passenger seat,
yeah,
or they put it in behind them. And then when they're getting back out, they reach behind and lift a heavy bag at that awkward angle back into the front of the car and get out. And that can cause pain in the shoulder as well. Even just that,
right,
was a shoulder
guilty
injury. So they're really basic things, but you wouldn't notice them necessarily in day-to-day life. It's only that we've seen these patterns develop that we know to warn people about them.
So we did the crossover strap. You're a little bit happier with that in terms of distributing the weight.
Yes.
But does that affect the hip then? Because the tendency with those straps is that because they're longer, that weight might be supported by your hip.
So again, it depends. Again, we're looking at the fit of that. So if something is kind of hanging outside of your body, then that's not as good. If it's close into your body, it's closer to your center of mass, which is basically how your weight is being pulled down by gravity. So if you have to accommodate for something that's wider out, if you think about the baby car seats, they're very awkward to carry because they're so wide. It's away from your body's center of mass. So you have to kind of strain to hold it out there.
Yes.
Whereas if you have something that's closer to the center of your body, it's easier to carry that for a longer period.
That's why the close-fitting backpack tends to work.
That's it, exactly.
Can we go back to the type of problems then that you can develop as a result of this? You explained the trapezius, the large muscle that sometimes gets into a bit of bother, does it?
Yeah, that's it. So that comes from the very base of your skull right out to your shoulder and then it comes down into the middle part of the spine. It's a big triangular muscle. So you can get, well, you could even get a headache from this because you've little nerves that pass through the muscle up at the top of the neck there. You can get pain in the actual kind of belly of the muscle itself, which is just between the neck and the shoulder. That's where you see a lot of people kind of pressing in during the day if they've had a busy day or a long commute. And it can even manifest in the upper part of the spine as well. The muscle spans a large enough area. But then, of course, that's not the only muscle working there. You have lots of other muscles that are all working in conjunction with that. So it's about that distribution of load and that position. Do you get used to that hunched position? And gradually over time, that becomes your default. Every time you lift your bag, you stick the shoulder up like it's a little hook holding the bag on.
Mm-hmm.
So again, we're looking at that. You know, we talked about posture before, and there's no one good posture, but it's about allowing your body to change position regularly so you're not in that position for a long period of time with that heavy weight hanging off it.
So if you have that problem, if you've developed it and now you have a light bulb moment because you realise that's probably because of the bag I'm carrying, how can you address it? How can you fix it?
So prune your stuff, that's the first thing. Look at the type of bag that you're using. Can you get a more supportive bag? Can you make sure that it fits you? Can you look at how you go about your day? And are there times when you bring the bag that you maybe don't need to bring that bag? Are there times when you maybe nip out for lunch and you could even have like a little small bag in work that you just run out with your keys and your phone in, mm-hmm, rather than bringing everything with you every single time you go? So it's about just sort of a little bit of planning, looking at your day and thinking, right, how do I minimise how much load I'm carrying at a particular time.
Right, being sensible, in other
words.
Yeah,
it's sort of common sense stuff. But, you know, it's so easy that we forget about it.
Absolutely, we do need to be reminded. Jenny, thanks so much for coming in.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Escuche de nuevo la grabación.
So you're getting tired there. So it's basically slouching, essentially. Okay. So if you pull that shoulder blade back and engage the muscles between the two shoulder blades, that's your base of support for anything that's heavy that you're having to maintain using your arm. So if you keep those shoulder muscles in position and you don't let the shoulder drop forward, you've got a much more stable base of support from the shoulder blade right down through the arm. Because anything that you have to do or push or lift with your arm, the actual strength comes from the shoulder blade muscles.
Would you prefer that people weren't carrying things around all day?
I would prefer that if they carry them around, that they have them in a backpack.
Yeah.
On both shoulders.
And also that they've made themselves strong enough to be able to withstand that load.
That's it, absolutely. So we're back to that kind of World Health Organization recommendation of 2 strengthening sessions per week for people under the age of 65 and 3 over the age of 65. So having that strength in your muscles to be able to tolerate something that you have to do outside of your normal comfort zone of movement, that helps safeguard against these niggles.
Is carrying the backpack or the handbag, though, not resistance training in itself?
It depends. It depends on that accumulation and how you're doing it. So if you're strong enough to begin with and you're managing that load so that you're not carrying it for maybe 2 hours at a time, it's all about if you can tolerate it for short periods of time and you build up your tolerance, then you get strong for it. But if you're not strong enough and then you suddenly have to do it out of the blue for 2 or 3 hours, that's where the problem comes, because your body is not able to tolerate that and it has to adjust and make those adaptations. And they then accumulate stress in your system that if you don't watch out for, it builds over time and you get this development of a kind of a niggly, seems to come out of the blue type injury.
And I think people would be surprised if they thought that that niggle that they have in some part of their back is coming from what they're carrying around.
That's it, absolutely. So when we see people come into the clinic and they come in with a huge big bag and they're complaining about pain in the neck and the shoulder, that's the first thing we talk about. What's in that bag? How often are you carrying it around? And in fact, a lot of people, they get into their car, into the driver's seat with a big heavy bag, then they put the heavy bag onto the passenger seat,
yeah,
or they put it in behind them. And then when they're getting back out, they reach behind and lift a heavy bag at that awkward angle back into the front of the car and get out. And that can cause pain in the shoulder as well. Even just that,
right,
was a shoulder
guilty
injury. So little, they're really basic things, but you wouldn't notice them necessarily in day-to-day life. It's only that we've seen these patterns develop that we know to warn people about them.
So we did the crossover strap. You're a little bit happier with that in terms of distributing the weight.
Yes.
But does that affect the hip then? Because the tendency with those straps is that because they're longer, that weight might be supported by your hip.
So again, it depends. Again, we're looking at the fit of that. So if something is kind of hanging outside of your body, then that's not as good. If it's close into your body, it's closer to your center of mass, which is basically how your weight is being pulled down by gravity. So if you have to accommodate for something that's wider out, if you think about the baby car seats, they're very awkward to carry because they're so wide. It's away from your body's center of mass. So you have to kind of strain to hold it out there.
Yes.
Whereas if you have something that's closer to the center of your body, it's easier to carry that for a longer period.
That's why the close fitting backpack tends to work.
That's it, exactly.
Can we go back to the type of problems then that you can develop as a result of this? You explained the trapezius, the large muscle that sometimes gets into a bit of bother, does it?
Yeah, that's it. So that comes from the very base of your skull right out to your shoulder and then it comes down into the middle part of the spine. It's a big triangular muscle. So you can get, well, you could even get a headache from this because you've little nerves that pass through the muscle up at the top of the neck there. You can get pain in the actual kind of belly of the muscle itself, which is just between the neck and the shoulder. That's where you see a lot of people kind of pressing in during the day if they've had a busy day or a long commute. And it can even manifest in the upper part of the spine as well. The muscle spans a large enough area. But then, of course, that's not the only muscle working there. You have lots of other muscles that are all working in conjunction with that. So it's about that distribution of load and that position. Do you get used to that hunched position? And gradually over time, that becomes your default. Every time you lift your bag, you stick the shoulder up like it's a little hook holding the bag on.
Mm-hmm.
So again, we're looking at that. You know, we talked about posture before, and there's no one good posture, but it's about allowing your body to change position regularly so you're not in that position for a long period of time with that heavy weight hanging off it.
So if you have that problem, if you've developed it and now you have a light bulb moment because you realise that's probably because of the bag I'm carrying, how can you address it? How can you fix it?
So prune your stuff, that's the first thing. Look at the type of bag that you're using. Can you get a more supportive bag? Can you make sure that it fits you? Can you look at how you go about your day? And are there times when you bring the bag that you maybe don't need to bring that bag? Are there times when you maybe nip out for lunch and you could even have like a little small bag in work that you just run out with your keys and your phone in, mm-hmm, rather than bringing everything with you every single time you go? So it's about just sort of a little bit of planning, looking at your day and thinking, right, how do I minimize how much load I'm carrying at a particular time.
Right, being sensible, in other words.
Yeah, it's sort of common sense stuff. But, you know, it's so easy that we forget about it.
Absolutely, we do need to be reminded. Jenny, thanks so much for coming in.
Dispone ahora de un minuto para comprobar sus respuestas. Este es el final de la tarea 3. Aquí acaba la prueba de comprensión oral. Por favor, siga las instrucciones del profesorado en su aula.